Workers were considered to be good workers. They were given the most dangerous jobs, and they were paid half of what Western white Canadian laborers were given. At the end of the railway construction, there was a recession, and we created a federal head tax to stop more immigration of Chinese laborers into Canada. We created punitive bylaws in Vancouver that limited where Chinese people could live, work, and what professions that they could partake in. And the Depression led to an anti-Asian exclusionary league, and labor leaders and politicians organized a rally that was going to start at City Hall in Vancouver, which was just down the street near Maine and Hastings at that time. And they rallied for a white Canada, a white BC, and a white Vancouver, and the exclusion of Chinese workers. But this labor rally turned into a riot, and the politicians and workers went into what is now Chinatown, and an area where Japanese residents lived, and they destroyed businesses and houses, and they were stopped right on Powell Street by the residents of that area. And this is just a few blocks east from here. East is that way. And Mackenzie King, who was Minister of Labor at that time, came out to investigate. And at that time, he found out about the legal opium industry here in Vancouver. And he wrote in his diary later that we'll get some good out of this riot. And he wrote a report that he claimed that we needed to regulate the opium trade and opium dens. And so we had our first legislation in 1908 and then later in 1911 that criminalized the possession of opium for smoking. And then later, cocaine and morphine were criminalized for use without a prescription. Well, we know that it's very different, the smoking of opium, than injecting heroin or chewing a coca leaf and having coca tea, than using refined cocaine. But by criminalizing these plant-based drugs, our market, the illegal market, started to bring in more refined drugs and find Canada for those drugs. It's hard to sometimes think about the level of discrimination against Chinese people and others that were non-white in Canada. But here's a cartoon from the 1800s. This is a picture that doesn't come up, but it's a white woman in an opium den. She's surrounded by racialized men of color. And there were these fears about white women being, as I said, corrupted by Chinese opium smokers. Emily Murphy is our first sort of moral reformer besides Mackenzie King, and she wrote a book called The Black Candle. And here she writes about the fears. This is a picture from her book. When she acquires a habit, she does not know what lies before her. Later, she does not care. She also talks about marijuana addicts becoming raving maniacs, and they're liable to kill anybody. She talked about Chinatown just down the street as the headquarters of drug trafficking for all of Canada. And she asked for harsher laws and deportation, the criminalization of marijuana. And these things occurred. We then enacted harsher laws and deported 125 Chinese residents in 1924. But of course, these drugs remain legal and accessible to Canadians, even though we know that they're health harms are much more. So our drug strategy from 1908 to the 1960s was focus on law enforcement, and the RCMP actually shapes law and drug knowledge. A ban on maintenance prescriptions. So unlike Britain, where doctors could prescribe drug maintenance for patients who were addicted, Canadian physicians were not allowed to do this. And in the United States, they opened up maintenance clinics for a number of years. They were closed down later, but we didn't have this. And so it really altered the face of what could be possible for people who were addicted, and there was no interest in any type of alternative drug treatments. These are some other parts of our drug policy, searching without a warrant, reverse onus of proof, where you had to prove you were innocent. We had that for no other crime, and harsh prison sentencing. And we used the term the criminal addict from the 1940s on, and what this meant was that your criminality was primary. So even if you stopped using the drug, you were seen as a menace to society. And a number of reports talked about this addict colony in the East End of Vancouver. And for women, it was really a sorry sight. At that time, most women who were known legal drug users had their children apprehended. And they were seen as immoral and basically street workers. But we had our first drug treatment movement and a resistance to the criminal model of prohibition in 1952 with the Ranta Report. And they really criticized incarceration of people who were addicted and said that addiction is a medical issue, not a criminal justice issue. And they supported diverse drug treatment and maintenance programs, education. But these were ignored. And instead, we enacted one of the harshest drug laws in the world, the Narcotic Control Act of 1961. And at that time, in 1971, there were only 17 marijuana possession arrests. Marijuana wasn't a popular used drug in Canada in the early 1960s. But what was happening here, right outside of Vancouver, was the Hollywood Hospital that opened in 1957 and started to treat people who were addicted to alcohol and had other psychological issues with LSD. And many Hollywood celebrities came to this private hospital to be treated. We also saw a huge shift in the emergence of the modern-day pharmaceutical industry. And now we have over 10,000 drugs to choose from or to be prescribed. But probably one of the biggest changes was the counterculture movement in the 1960s, where youth rejected the work ethic, were exploring states of consciousness and other ways to see the universe. And here was in the gas town, which is just close by. I'm all turned around, but it's that way. It was a gas town solidarity smoke-in and street jamboree, and people were asking for the legalization of marijuana, but most people just remember it as the gas town riot because the police came in on their horses swinging at very peaceful bystanders. And in 1972, we saw over 10,000 marijuana possession arrests in Canada. And then because of these rising arrests, the federal government decided to do the Ledain Commission, and they looked into drug use across Canada. And they were very critical of law enforcement and said that we should reform our cannabis laws, provide more alternative treatments and methadone maintenance. And so we did see an expansion of treatment options, but most of these treatment options were abstinence-based. And so it was just basically stopping you from using the drug, all drugs except for the legal drugs like tea, coffee, and cigarettes. But interestingly enough, there was very little support in terms of helping you stop drugs. Right here in Vancouver, we saw the emergence of HempBC. Mark Emery was a leading person in these ventures with Cannabis Canada, the magazine, now the website Cannabis Culture, the Cannabis Cafe, now the New Amsterdam Cafe, and the BC Marijuana Party. But still, with all these efforts, 95% of the federal drug budget was earmarked for criminal justice, and drug arrests increased. And we saw in the neighborhood of the downtown east side, which is one of the poorest neighborhoods in Canada, which is just about four blocks east of here, we saw a rise in heroin overdose deaths, HIV AIDS rates, and hepatitis C. So there were calls for a safer injection site at that time and more diverse treatments. And the federal government and the provincial government failed to respond in any big way. And so the back alley on Powell Street, a few blocks from here, was open. And it was an informal safer injection site set up by drug users themselves. And slowly a social justice movement in the downtown east side emerged, and they called for more harm reduction services, the safer injection site. Van Du, our drug user union, emerged here in Vancouver. It's known globally and has really made an impact in Vancouver in relation to drug programs. And there was a call for the end of prohibition. The BC Compassion Club opened in Vancouver in 1997, and they provided good organic marijuana to people, as well as a wellness center. But because the federal government failed to act, there was a demonstration in downtown Eastside called 1,000 Crosses, and it was to bring attention to people in Vancouver and around Canada about the drug deaths and the HIV/AIDS, hepatitis C rates, and the epidemic. And here the picture isn't showing, but in 2002 there was another demonstration in downtown Eastside, now with 2,000 crosses. Out of some of this grassroots agitation came a framework for action in 2001, written by the Drug Policy Coordinator for Vancouver, Donald McPherson, asking that we have more prevention, treatment, and harm reduction. Unfortunately, some of these initiatives were ignored, and we got more enforcement in the downtown east side. But we did see the official safer injection site open in 2003. We saw the Iboga Therapy House and the Sunshine Coast outside of Vancouver opened in 2003 as well. But we've had a bit of an obstacle, and that was with the election of the Conservatives in 2006, and their mandate was to punish drug people who use criminalized drugs and to put them in prison. But this is contrary to what the residents in the downtown east side said. Over 1,000 people were surveyed and came to forums in 2010, and they said a priority of theirs was ending drug prohibition and setting up a legal regulatory policy for those drugs that are criminalized now. So what do we have today? We still see that youth, the poor, Aboriginal, racialized people are vulnerable to arrest and imprisonment. Over 1,800 nonviolent drug arrests a year. Most of these are for possession and cannabis. There's been little impact, as I said in the beginning, on drug use rates, addiction rates, or the illegal market. And now we have the Safer Streets and Community Act, which has mandatory minimums for quite a number of drug offenses. We have prison building and prison crowding in Canada now. But still, the social justice movement to have a different type of drug policy in Canada is as strong as ever. And they look at drug policy as a health, social justice, and human rights issue, claiming that drug prohibition is expensive, ineffective. It increases discrimination and harm to individuals and communities. It demonizes plant-based medicines, and it legitimizes punishment. And it diverts our tax dollars away from housing, health, education, and alternative treatments. And so what's going on here in the downtown east side and elsewhere in Vancouver is part of a global resistance to international drug prohibition. And we've had some very interesting local initiatives like Sensible BC's to initiate the stopping the police from arresting people for marijuana possession. And recently, all of the mayors in BC signed on to trying to work towards a legal regulation of marijuana. And so I'll just end with this, is that this social movement is moving towards drug peace and reminding us that laws, policy, they're not static, and we'd rather drug peace rather than war. Thank you.